Well, I promised Lochner that I would talk about animism. Here we go. So launching into the application, so to speak, of imagination. As I said, I was fascinated by this comment of Bhante's in Living with Awareness. I would go so far as to say that a universe conceived of as dead cannot be a universe in which one stands any chance of attaining enlightenment. And of course, they famously argued some time ago that for there to be a genuine development of Buddhism in the West, there needed to be a revival of paganism, which we all happily misunderstood and enjoyed it too. And of course, when you read the suttas, what really strikes one is the extent to which the Buddha lived in an animate world. The Vedic gods seemed to be around, the sky gods were around and in interaction with the Buddha. However you want to take that, whether you take it as ironic or not, they're definitely represented. The yakas, the earth spirits, were all represented very strongly, and the Buddha seemed to have a keen awareness of them and an ability to interrelate with them. He's presented in that sort of way. And the common Buddhist tradition from then on has been that spiritual practitioners, dhammic practitioners, can access these sort of forces and can enter into some sort of communication with them. So, what are we to make of that? That's the question that I put to Bhante. Does it mean we have to start making offerings to ancient Buddhist gods, for instance? That would be one way of thinking of it, that we need to start taking up the Indian gods and making offerings to them, the four kings or whatever, taking figures from the canon and worshipping them. Or does it mean that we have to develop some sort of worship of the local gods, Woden or Fiorgaivis in Wales, and so on and so forth? Do we have to find these local gods and reanimate them? Or do we have to go back to the ancient Greek gods, or what? And should we all be going off to Stonehenge and dressing up as druids and dancing around? Unfortunately, Bhante didn't seem to think that was the way forward for us. Or fortunately. You can do if you want, of course, if it's what turns you on. I think in some ways you could say that these ancient gods are as alien to us now as are the pantheons of the East. The whole nature of culture and consciousness has changed so radically that we can't take them in the same way that our ancestors would have taken them. So what must we do? Well, the fundamental issue is, why does it matter? And what Bhante says is that it matters because it's the basis of ethics. Our capacity to respond to the world as alive is the basis of ethics. Thinking about this further, I came to the conclusion you could think of ethics in terms of three different kinds of ethics. There's an ethics that is based on rational self-interest, where you've come to believe, perhaps through experience, perhaps through faith, in the karmic kind of conditionality, and you come to the conclusion that skillful action is good for you. So your ethics is based on a refined self-interest. And maybe that's where ethics often starts for people, and it's a good place to start. And traditionally Buddhism does encourage that approach. But there's a deeper level of ethics, which is more to do with a sense of natural empathy for the life in others, the life in the world around one. I'll say much more about that, of course. There's, of course, a third kind of ethics, which is an ethics that unfolds with the Dharma Niyama processes. When you transcend self-clinging to any extent or to a decisive extent, then you find yourself naturally responding to the world around you in a creative way, in a helpful way, without any premeditation, without any thought. As I talked about last night, it's bodhicitta is not an emotion, it's not a sentiment. It's a completely spontaneous response to the needs around. So you could say these three levels of ethics. There's an ethics which is self-interested and reflective. There's a self-interest which is increasingly spontaneous, natural, based on empathy of life for life. And there's an ethics which is spontaneous and even more radically deep sense, in which there's not really any sense of separation. There's simply a response to need, to suffering, wherever it is, without any sense of self at all. Empathy, in a way, is initially a response of like for like. It's a recognition of something in the other that is like something in you. So there is a subjective dimension to it, but it's inter-subjective. It transcends the subject-object dichotomy by identifying or finding the identity in the other. So it's this second kind of ethics that really raises the animist question. So what Bhante is arguing, or putting forward, advancing, is that there is a completely natural and spontaneous response of life for life. So that if you are living yourself, and especially if you're self-conscious, you feel yourself resonating with, responding to what is alive around you, at least to some extent, to some level, to the extent that you let yourself. So I find this fascinating, just living out in the countryside and surrounded by sheep. And I know what's happening to those sheep. I know why they're there. And I watch the farmer come round. He's a very nice fellow. Very good, friendly, kindly fellow on the whole. But for him, it's just money. They're not living creatures. They're just... he's not unkind to them in a functional sense. He wouldn't want to hurt them he's not cruel or anything like that. As far as he's concerned, they're just things that are part of a factory process. For me, I sense a very strong affinity with those sheep, in certain respects. They're alive. They're sensitive. They clearly don't find life very easy. For a start, they're unnaturally crowded together, which is very disturbing, socially speaking, because sheep are actually extremely territorial animals. There's even a word for it in Welsh, cnefin, which means because the sheep know their own territory. Hefted in English, I believe. So it's very disturbing for them. They're crammed into a field with too many of them, and they're constant friction and tension amongst them. You can see that it's quite easy to see that their life is not a particularly pleasant one. And I can feel it. It's not something sentimental. It's not something I think through. It's completely immediate, spontaneous, I was going to say automatic, spontaneous. What Bhante's saying is that this is natural to a human being, to feel an identity with life. Of course, most simply with the human life around us, but even with the other living creatures. There are other forces, of course, in our lives. The forces of self-interest and cultural forces overlay that. And probably most people can remember even this process in their childhood in relation to animals. I think it's quite a common experience. I remember my parents kept pigs. It was after the war and supplementing diet and so forth. They kept pigs. And it was a terrible problem what to do when, you know, one of the pigs had to be slaughtered. What the problem was, what to do with me? Because for me, I've become so sort of fond of these pigs. And, you know, I had to be sort of taken away and then come back and find that the pig wasn't there. The pig was called Wait For. Because whenever we went out, it would run down the drive, squealing, "Wait for me, wait for me." But I think it's quite a common experience with children to have something of a struggle with the recognition that the food that's on their plate actually once was a living creature. And there has to be a conscious overcoming of that. Well, not a conscious, there has to be a kind of a blunting of sensibility to overcome it. And you get some quite astonishing stories in war. I remember a Mitra, a Desmond Fitzgerald, do you remember him from the RBC? An Irish Mitra, who had, as a young man, been inducted into the IRA, as every young Irishman is, of course. He was taken out on a raid, and it was a bungled operation. The British had got alert to the raid, and he was left as a rear guard because he'd never used his gun before. And they were surprised, and he found himself at the end of a rifle, a British soldier's rifle. And his rifle was up, the British soldier's rifle was up, they were looking down the sights, and they looked into each other's eyes. And he could see in the eyes of the soldier exactly what he could feel in himself, a deep sense of reluctance to harm another being, another human being. And he said they looked at each other for, you know, what seemed like minutes, probably just a microsecond, of recognition of each other's common humanity. And Des said he just couldn't shoot. He knew he couldn't shoot. The soldier shot, because of course he'd been trained, and he'd been trained precisely for this eventuality. I'm telling me the story, then he pulled down his shirt and showed me the bullet hole through his shoulder. And I found it a very, very powerful story of the way in which human beings do have a natural empathy for each other, and which has to be overcome. And what an army does is it systematically trains you to overcome that sense. And I've spoken to people who've been in war, and they say that the first time you do it is terrible, but the second time it's easier, and the third time you don't even notice. You just become used to it. Of course, there are those who don't have this sense, but most human beings will have that natural sense of reluctance to kill another human being, because they'll recognise in a way themselves in the other. I think the identification of this as something natural is very, very significant. And again, it's of a piece with everything I'm trying to say, that a lot of this discussion of the language of imagination is about discovering something, not adding something on, and encouraging something to emerge more fully and effectively, something that is naturally there within us. Bhante said that it's at a very deep level, a sort of resonance of life for life. A resonance that goes to insects and worms and all sorts of things like that. Even things you might find disgusting. There's a sort of deep reluctance if you are unspoiled, if there's not too much kind of countervailing conditioning. You're reluctant to remove, to take. He took it further than that. He said that this natural resonance is not merely for life in the obvious sense, in the biological sense. It's not only for utu-niyama processes or manu-niyama processes, or those that have those processes. In a way, there's a resonance, there's an identity with all inorganic matter. with natural forces like a storm and so on, which is why our ancestors saw those storms as embodying or being the expression of some divine force. And it's hard in the middle of a thunderstorm not to feel there's something alive out there. So Banti said that he thought that it was natural to see the world as living, even down to the level of the inorganic. And he spoke himself of experiences he had. He remembered particularly going to an exhibition of tantric art at the Haywood Gallery in London. I remember it myself. I remember going there in the 1970s, I think, 1960s. And he said that in that exhibition, and I remember this myself and being very, very struck by it, there were some great stones which had been shaped by the river, by a river. So they were very, very smooth, and they sort of egg-shaped. And they had a, you know, the sand had indented them in very various ways. I don't know whether anybody else saw these. And Bante said that when he saw these, he felt something coming from them. And he could completely understand how they'd been worshipped as Shiva, in fact. That even inorganic matter, what we would usually call dead matter, is not really dead. It's not alive, obviously, in the sense that even an insect is alive, or, and especially not in a way that a human being is alive, but in a much more fundamental sense, we have an identity with it, which in moods of great receptivity, of great imaginative openness, of great empathy, we can feel, we can touch. And one of the reasons why the Romantic poets were so significant in Western culture is that they were protesting against the increasing deadening of the world around them. You know, the dark satanic mills of Blake and so on. They saw the world being gradually denatured and becoming merely the stuff of human engineering, as it were. And they were protesting strongly and very, very effectively. They clearly themselves felt very strongly this deep natural response. Some of it is overworked and sentimental, but clearly they're talking about something that's very deep in human experience and which is represented in the life of our ancestors by their strong animation of the universe, their peopling of the universe with spirit forces, which they felt it necessary to be in communication with. Sometimes, of course, a propitiatory communication, one where they had to appease the natural forces and control them through through offerings and so forth. Some that were much more benign, beneficent, where they were courting beneficent influences and trying to keep them in play. But they had a very, very strong sense of this. And of course you get this still very much in India, in the Indian village. And not just in the Indian village, in the Indian, in middle class homes in India. A very strong sense that the universe is still animate. One of the things that really blows my mind is seeing somebody working on a computer with a statue of Ganesh on top. And before turning on the computer, I've seen somebody take darshan of Ganesh and then turn on the computer. I've seen good Buddhists do that, but that's another story. it's because it's beginnings, you know, you're turning on the computer. The computer god. And I've seen people, you can get now screensavers, which are Ganesh screensavers, they're very popular. So Bante says that this animation that our ancestors gave the universe is a way of expressing what is natural to us too. Not necessarily that it will take that form for us. We will not necessarily people the world in the same way. We may do. Some of us do that. I've certainly friends who see spirits in nature and so on. I don't myself. I'm like Shariputra in this respect. I could not see a mud sprite. in other respects, I'm not so like him. Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it, that Modigliana could see the yucca, but Shariputra could not. So, but Shariputra was a deeply sensitive man. He was a very kindly man, very concerned about others, very, very helpful. Everybody knew they could get teachings from Shariputra, and so on. So, the key factor is the extent to which one is able to feel empathy. And what Bhante is saying is that empathy cannot be merely restricted to human beings. If it's restricted to human beings, it's restricted. It only goes a certain distance. There needs to be a strong sense of resonance with the entire world. So what I understand him to be saying is that, because he was rather laconic about all this, because it seemed so obvious to him. And he pointed me to a poem that he wrote in 1950, I think, called Animist. Which is, I guess, goes something like, oh, maybe I can even find it here. Yes. I feel like going on my knees to this old mountain and these trees. 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, I could have worshipped them, I know. But if one did so in this age, they'd lock him in a padded cage. We've made the world look mean and small and lost the wonder of it all. So for Bhante, this seems to have been a strong sense from very early on. He doesn't seem to, although he has seen a spirit or two, it doesn't seem to be a sort of a strong element in his makeup, but a strong response to the world as alive. He said that he feels in this respect his mind is medieval. I know some would agree with that in other ways, but that's another question. His mind is medieval in the sense that it is organized hierarchically, that it sees the universe as a hierarchy of being, in the great chain of being sense, but also sees the universe as animate. He says this has always been natural to him. In a way, he was never scientized. He was never materialistic-ified. Of course, he worked for a long time in India, and it's very hard in India to... it used to be in India. Now it's much easier to feel that the world is dead, especially in the cities. So it seems to have been always very natural to him. So I couldn't really get him saying very much about kind of what to do. What it seems to amount to is to a recognition that response is natural. As with everything connected with what I'm putting under the broad heading of imagination, it's a recognition of something that you do. It's like a magnet. A magnet is attracted to whatever a magnet is attracted to, to iron filings. Iron filings are attracted to the magnet, to another magnet, thank you. It doesn't have to sort of think, oh, I think I will now move towards that other magnet. Of course, it can be held down. And in a way, our whole culture and the deadening effect, the lost wonder of it all, holds down that natural response there is of life for life. May not necessarily be entirely a comfortable one, as I've already pointed out. You may feel very worried or scared about the life around you, but it will be there. The response will be there if we can allow ourselves to open up to it. My most powerful experience of this, under the influence of certain substances, I remember taking an LSD trip and wandering into a forest. I first of all had a very interesting encounter with a cow. But that's another question. But I remember wandering into this forest. I was completely unprepared. You know, the trip was just taking off. And I suddenly became aware that I was surrounded by consciousness. That's the only way I could think of it. I could feel the powerful moods of the trees around me. And to this day, I'm convinced that what I experienced was objective. It's just that usually, you know, I've structured my mind in such a way that I don't feel it. But I was pinging through that forest, sort of just unable to relate to what was happening. I was completely unprepared for it. And I felt very distinctly the different moods of the different trees. I can't now reproduce what it was, but I remember oaks, a wonderful, very, very powerful feeling from the oak, very, very strong, very deep, very calm. Other trees I found quite almost jagged, you could say. And as I say, this was not something I was going into the woods to experience. It just happened. And for me, that's my most powerful experience of this whole area. Since taking to meditation and so forth, I would say that I've encountered that more constantly in a more gentle way, and much more in association with animals and human beings. But it's a natural function of imagination to respond to life. And so once we were able to acknowledge that, or at least accept as a working hypothesis that supposition, then we can begin to open up to what's around us and notice our responses. In the field of imagination, I think the key thing is not to theorize and not to tell yourself what you ought to be experiencing, but to allow yourself to observe and identify responses that may be there, if you see what I mean. It's even dangerous to say responses that will be there. But you start with a hypothesis that you are naturally responding to the life around you, and you look, what is going on in my experience in this respect? You know, here we are, we're all together here, and we're interacting at the level of, words and thoughts and so forth. But there are other interactions going on between us. And I don't mean at the fussy old psychological level of, I used to sleep with her and so on, all that. But at the level of the blood, you might say, of the heart, of the instinct, at a completely natural level, there's an interaction going on between us. We're interrelating just because we're living beings together. Well, that happens with any living thing. The problem is that we live in a world in which that is no longer valued or even recognized, in a world in which the natural environment is held at bay. Living in a city, it's not too bad in Cambridge, but you go to Bombay or somewhere like that, natural world, well, it's only there in the viruses that are around. The natural world is not, as it were, smoothly and comfortably there in relation to people, certainly in slums and so forth. So we live in a denatured environment. I think that's increasingly made worse by the technology that we are immersed in. I found it shocking to watch the technologization of India. I'm more conscious of it there. For instance, 10 years ago, when people went on retreat, they were completely out of contact for a week or 2 weeks. These days, I've taken to collecting people's mobile phones at the beginning of retreats, and I try to get the same number of mobile phones as there are people. The trouble is, people have two. And I've so often been in meditation, and suddenly a mobile phone will go. I know that happens here too. The problem is that I was on a big retreat in Karnataka, a general retreat, a couple of thousand people, and I noticed that my phones kept on going all the time. On one side of the room, it was on the women's side of the room. So I talked to my translator, who was a woman, Dharma Mitra. I said, "Well, can you get them to, really turn their mobile phones on?" She said, "Oh, don't you realise most of them don't know how to? Their sons turn them on, then give them to him." Anyway, that's beside the point. There's a bit of light relief. A bit of light relief. Well, Srimala doesn't know how to turn hers on. I've watched the technologisation of India and the extent to which people are increasingly living on their mobile phones. You know, somebody can come to see me, and it's not easy to get to see Subhuti. They can make lots of arrangements for Dharmashala, and they get to see me. And in the middle of our conversation, the mobile phone goes. They'll pick up the mobile phone and start having a conversation. Because some way or other, that remote communication seems more important than the one that's actually going on straight in front of you. And you see it here, don't you? People wandering along in the middle of a lovely park, speaking on the mobile phone, or up on the top of the mountain near where I live. The first thing people do when they get up there is take photographs with their mobile phone and then ring everybody up to say, I'm on top of a mountain. I remember once going to see a concert done in the canals in Birmingham. And somebody in front of me watched the whole concert on his mobile phone. So in some way we're sort of removing ourselves from reality increasingly, occupying what some call a secondary reality, a constructed reality. In fact, in a way, it's a tertiary reality, because it's a normal thing to construct a secondary reality. We all do that anyway. But it's a tertiary reality, which is twice removed from our actual experience. That's why I think the emphasis on Kayagata, sati, is so important, the emphasis on body mindfulness, because the emphasis of modern technology, that the emphasis of modern life is against it. We are moving in the other direction by and large, increasingly distanced from a natural empathic connection. Of course, mobile phone call is a sort of connection. And in a way, it does demand a quite high degree of imagination. I don't know whether you've sort of experienced this after a retreat. Making a phone call, you become aware of what a huge effort it costs to get in front of you the image of the other person at the other end, to fill in from the what is it, 20% of the voice, the auditory content of their voice, their whole voice. It's a huge effort of a psychic effort, which I find exhausting and try to avoid as much as I can. So the emphasis of modern life is against this direct connection. So I think we have to do a lot of work to bring ourselves back into a living connection with the world around us. One of the most important things in our favour is the strong environmental concern. Of course, a lot of that concern is first-order ethics, if you see what I mean. It's a recognition that we are spoiling things for ourselves. But the good thing about first-order ethics is that it leads to second-order ethics. Do you see what I mean? If you develop the skillful actions out of self-interest, it modifies your consciousness so that you're more sensitive. So I think that if people do, I joke about it, we recycle their glass and sort of do the things that they think will help to keep us going against environmental crisis, they probably will be much more aware of the world around them. But I think that's something that we need to encourage and build on. We ourselves need to do it, but we need to encourage people around us to have more and more and deeper natural empathy with the world around us. I'm quite interested, my builder in Wales used to be a sheep farmer, and he'd like to be a sheep farmer again. So I asked him, why? Why do you want to be a sheep farmer? And he said, well, the first thing he said, well, sheep don't answer back. But then he went on to say, well, you're involved with living creatures and so on. So I said, yes, but what about the end? And he said, yeah, yes. Well, you don't see that. But my feeling was he'd find it difficult now, that he's sort of lost the habit of of deadening himself. So we need to ourselves lose the habit of deadening ourselves. We need to open ourselves up more and more fully to the natural world around us. We're probably quite good as a community on the whole, but we could be so much better. And develop is something much more difficult to speak of, and it touches on the cultural issues that Vajrasadhu was referring to. A culture needs to develop amongst us in which our way of speaking expresses an awareness of the universe as alive. Our ancestors did that through personifying. It's probably not realistic for most of us. Some can. But we need to develop a way of speaking that recognizes the life in the world around us, in the universe around us, in the things, in the objects.
Do you think there's anything in science or in any sort of scientific discoveries or theories that helps reanimate the universe?
The problem is, it's not really my field. I haven't done much reading in that field. But science is full of surprises, and you get this term science, but it's actually a multiplicity of different movements and processes, and there's a lot on the, as it were, fringes of science that are very sympathetic to this point of view. I don't think they're generally accepted as mainstream. I know, for instance, there was the Rupert Sheldrake and all that material, but most people I've spoken to have a scientific background, get very snooty about that. But I don't see why that shouldn't be the case. So I wouldn't want to rule it out in principle. And I'm not really competent myself to speak much about science. There are probably others here who could. But. So yes, maybe I've said enough on that particular theme, and can just see what if there's anything that strikes anybody that you want to question or...
Can you expand a bit more on the difference between the second and the third...
Kind of ethics. Yeah. Well, the difference is the difference of self-identity. So in the second kind of ethics, your empathy is based on a sense that like those two soldiers, he's like me. So it's sort of based on me. Bante, I remember drawing that sort of diagram, the feeling goes out from you, touches the other person, and then comes back to you. So it's metta in the ordinary sense, a natural empathy.
Well, the third kind of ethics is natural, but in a much, much deeper sense. It's because you are driven, if that's the right word, you're animated by a force that is completely beyond self, which has nothing in it that could harm another, if you see what I mean, and that spontaneously identifies with life. So it's a very, very interesting, important distinction, and again, I think gives much richer meaning to the karmic dimension, that in the karmic dimension, you're encouraging this natural empathy. It's fascinating, isn't it, that Buddhism is about recognition of anatman. But the way you recognize anatman is by willed effort. Accept your agency to transcend your agency. So it's the same issue at work. This is all pretty straightforward in a way. Yeah, no, perhaps not.
One you left off as a rather tantalising point where you're saying we need to develop this culture when we talk about.
What on earth do you mean by that?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know because we don't have it yet. Or maybe we've got it, but not enough. And I've been thinking about this quite a lot since sort of working this out for myself. Just looking at my way of speaking and watching my thoughts. For instance, to tell you a slightly horrible story, the other day I was mowing the lawn and, a creature got caught in my mower. And a little creature. And I had that image in my mind for 2 days. I couldn't get rid of it. Well, I didn't want to get rid of it in a way. That made me feel, I don't want to mow the lawn again. I'm quite happy. Actually, I didn't really want to mow it in the first place. She made me. That's a joke, by the way. Oh dear, I'll have a glass of water. But yes, I sort of looking at the... I've always had a squeamishness about even cutting flowers. I don't like cutting flowers. And I was thinking, well, how would I sort of express this to somebody who didn't share my sort of sensibility? You know, a lot of people, even maybe amongst us, would think, that's a bit silly. I don't know what it would look like, but it would look different. That's what I believe. I believe that the way we talk and think is still strongly dominated by a materialist assumption. And I don't know what it's going to look like. Actually, I'm quite happy about that. I'd prefer to sort of let it emerge amongst us and not try to work it out. It can't be worked out, if you see what I mean. It can't be artificially created. It has to be out of the interaction of our sensibilities. Go on.
I suppose you get a thing when sometimes you wince about mechanistic language.
And yes, yeah.
You talked about not looking at the mind like a computer.
Yes, yeah.
So there's maybe things that we can pinpoint.
Yes. I do think metaphors that we use are extraordinarily powerful and dangerous. And I do worry about the computerization of the mind. The way I hear people talking, metaphors that people use... my operating system's down or whatever. I need a new chip or whatever. I've crashed. You know what I mean? And of course, it's obvious. And, you know, you can see that with early psychology, it draws on hydraulics, repression and all that. So we're naturally going to use the language to run. The Buddha used a lot of agricultural language. But I think the more directly connected with our physical senses that our metaphors are, the better. To keep us sensitized in this sort of way. I'm not a Luddite. I think computers are useful and so forth and so on. But I think we need to be careful about them and keep them in their right place and not allow them to dominate our own experience. I have a very strong sense of that. I was up at Guhyaloka writing my book on Bhante's ideas. I became so conscious that I was using a metaphor, the metaphor of the page, which was actually a screen, the metaphor of typing. I actually wasn't typing. You know, 10 years before that, I'd have touched a key and I would have physically put the ink onto the page. I've no idea how the blips and blops get onto the screen. I've no idea of it, and I can't even feel it. I have to metaphoricalize what I'm doing. So I worry that we become over dominated by the metaphors that we derive from our denatured existence. It's bound to happen to some extent, but I think that we need to... Yes, thank you for pointing that out. I wouldn't have thought of it. We need to be quite careful about... Our mechanization of imagination.
You seem to be saying from your own experience of whales and the like, sheep, that actually living in the countryside, which is certainly my experience, is a very good basis for sensibility to nature as compared with living in the centre of Cambridge.
Well, it certainly can be, but of course there are many other factors to be taken into consideration, and you can go to sleep in the countryside, and that's very often what does happen. Most people can't sustain it. I think a fairly frequent immersion in nature, in the literal sense, is pretty important. And I think that's why it's important that we have... beautiful retreat centres, country retreat centres, is why we're trying to get the Sangharakshita land project off the ground. We want a largish piece of land because it will be alive, and it will come alive more and more as the years go by. So I do think that it's important that we have that experience. However, in the city you get other benefits. You get the benefit of community for a start. You get the benefit of a stimulating culture and so on.
There's a third possibility there as well. You talk about city, countryside.
Ah, yeah.
A big third possibility there is the wilderness.
Ah, yes.
That
is
really connected with the imaginal and the imagination.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
To recognize that there's something that has been lost actually in
Britain. Yeah.
It's there in other parts of the world.
Yeah, and increasingly everywhere.
And the experience of wilderness is quite different.
Yes, we're completely untouched by humanity. One of the things I find very striking looking out over the scenery in Wales, it's a completely manicured environment by the enormous sculptural power of sheep, which can shape a landscape in an extraordinary way, of course under the dominance of humanity. So you're not really in a way in nature in the sense of wilderness, unless you go right up into the mountains. And even there, it's a bit sparse. Mm. Yes, it's quite different where you're in the midst of a jungle in Africa. I used to live in Africa, and you just wander into the jungle, and it's a very, very strange experience.
I mean, you spend quite a bit of time in a place like New Zealand.
Ah, yes.
You can't but help, after spending some time in the bush there, you sense there's something really primeval in that place.
Yeah, really, something far bigger than you. Yeah. Yeah. No.
You don't get that sense in the countryside, in the agricultural country.
Not to the same degree. Yeah, you get a hint of it, maybe. Yeah.
Hmm. I was just going to ask those three types of ethics that you described. Would you say that the third level is a truly spiritual level? I say that in the sense that the first two. I remember in the 80s watching programs by Richard Leakey, the famous archaeologist, and he described how some prototype of men, some communities didn't, some groups of prototype humans didn't cooperate very well, and other ones did, and it was the ones that did were the ones that actually survived.
Succeeded,
so there must have been something in them of the first two types that you're talking about. To get project humanity off the ground in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the third one seems to be something that's extra on top. It's not necessarily it's nothing to do with survival, as it were.
Yes. Yes, no, I think I'd agree with that. I think the interesting thing is the continuities between them.
Sure.
And it's something I find very interesting about the whole schema of the Niyamas, and to risk being misunderstood. It seems to me that the Dhamma Niyama, in a sense, runs all the way through. It only emerges as the Dhamma Niyama at that phase, but there is that upward momentum within all the Niyamas. So I'd say in a certain sense that the desire to cooperate, the feeling of empathy, is in some sense a prefiguration of the transcendent bodhicitta, in some sense. So, it's important to make the distinction, but it's important also to recognise the continuities. But yes, truly speaking, the dharmic level is the third kind. Everything to do with karma is only dharmic in the sense that it is serving a dharmic purpose, if you see what I mean. But it can serve an ordinary mundane purpose. You can act well out of just ordinary decency, and that will be a good thing, but it's not dharmic. Many people many from different religions and from no religion do try to live a good life, and that's a good thing, and it's definitely karmically efficacious, but it's not dharmic, to use that term rather than spiritual, which is a bit more ambiguous maybe. But yes, everybody, according to what Bhante is saying, is everybody has that natural resonance. And all life has that natural resonance. It's not, as somebody pointed out, it's not always benign. You can pick up on other living things without liking them. You know what I mean? You need to pick up on a predator, for instance, or a prey. But it's sensitive, if you see what I mean, without necessarily being metaphor. It's in humanity that begins to be a metaphor. Well, they're the same thing. Yeah. You could say exactly that, that alienated awareness is a failure of imagination in this sense. That you're not in contact with your natural responses. Yes.
Just wanted to share that I found that doing the six element practice... Particularly the first four stages is very, very helpful in just connecting with life as life, in a relationship with it. And that for me has been seemed a very useful thing that I can actually do. It helps sort of bring my imagination to life, to life in the context of sort of being nature, for example.
Yes, I think the six element practice is only really effective to the extent that you use your imagination, both to experience the elements within yourself. And I always, these days, teach the six element practice by directing people to the experience of the elements within them. So you feel the contact of your body with the ground, you hear the blood in your ears and so forth. But also you need a strong imaginative response to the elements in the world around you. I remember when we were doing this in Tuscany, when Bhante was giving what for me was the classic teaching on the six element practice, something he stressed very much, the imaginative connection with the elements around you, and recommending going and looking at the elements. It's not, of course, the primary purpose of the practice, but it's an effect of the practice and something that makes the practice effective. Well, it's not directly the purpose of the practice, yeah. Somebody else was...
Do you think, I hope you're already saying this, but do you think that if one is cultivating that sense of empathy with life per se around one, then that's going to naturally affect one's relationships with people, is that exactly?
Well, it should do, but human beings are so complicated, aren't they? So that, you know, people can love their cats and hate their neighbours. But I think if you're really developing that sort of sense of the living quality of things, it would be pretty hard to stop at before humanity, if you see what I mean. So I think that they go pari passu. I think they go together. That as you're developing the one, you'll develop the other. And they aid each other. And I think that a greater appreciation of life, in a broader sense, will deepen your sensitivity to other human beings. And your greater sensitivity to other human beings can be easily extended to an appreciation of the life around you. So, as I say, everything you say in these sort of areas, you can immediately find exceptions. We're going to find this with art, aren't we? But, you know, these natural responses, people can have very vivid responses to nature and be beasts. And, you know, Bhante always mentions this in connection with art, Philip Kaplow's recognition that the concentration camp guards, some of them were highly cultured people with a very strong appreciation of Aryan culture, and they'd go home at night and listen to Beethoven and Mozart and so forth, and apparently deeply appreciate it. They saw no conflict, ethical conflict, between that aesthetic response and an ethical one, or failure of ethics. So human beings are complex, but in general I'd agree with you that a real response to nature goes with a real response to humanity.
Responsible for oil well explosions in the sea,
So, in what way was I being simplistic?
You're talking about sort of higher sensitivity and environmental, you know, within the context of environmental concern, for instance, you spoke about. And certainly, I mean, it's my experience, as that oil well blew up and the oil spread, I think I was not alone in disliking quite a few of the big executives. And I tried to practice matter towards them, and it didn't really work. Mm. So if, in fact, the next few years are going to be increasingly an experience of trashing the planet, as I put it rather immersively, we're going to be wrestling with quite a lot of dislike.
I think I used a shorthand term, didn't I? I talked about environmental concern, and I wasn't referring to that in any political or economic sense. I was referring to it more as a growing awareness amongst ordinary people of that issue. I'm really suggesting that's something that, well, partly we need to encourage just for its own sake, but as Buddhists it's also a route into the development of the imagination, if you see what I mean. So, do you see what I mean? I wasn't trying to refer to the larger...
I understand the promotion. I'm simply saying what goes with it, given where we're at, over environmental concern, is that we're going to be wrestling with the matter about the people who are actually contributing substantially to...
Well, there's a subject for further reflection, if you see what I mean, and for further work. In a way, it doesn't make sense to love the planet and hate people, because in a way, you're saying you want one sort of life but not another. So, of course, there are going to be all sorts of issues to be worked out. But what I'm arguing is that I'm interested in areas where there are roots in, if you see what I mean. And this is a route in, even though there may be many pitfalls along the way.
To our own sensitivities,
yeah. But yes, it's not that once people start recycling their glass, they're going to love everybody. Yeah, Subhadra.
Like you are ice little creatures or something, so if you come out walking after the rain,
yes.
Do you not think there's a bit of a disconnect between our concern about creatures like that and the effect of our nation's foreign policy, which has killed over a million people in the East in the last 10 years?
So
I think there's a certain political naivety whereby they give up generally, but we don't think about that. Cut off.
Well, those sort of issues certainly arise. And one of the things that I think we do need to be starting to do is becoming more politically aware and beginning to try to see how our dharmic practice and our understanding of the nature of things bears upon our interaction with the society around us. I could have spent a weekend talking about Buddhism and social change, which is another of my themes of the moment. Right? I do think that we are not sufficiently interacting with the issues of the moment around us. But that is another issue, another question. Broadly, I agree with you. Of course, foreign policy is very complex. I think we need to start to enter the political debate, bring the Dhamma to bear on the political debate. It's much easier in India, because it's more obvious.
Do you think it's possible to be very environmentally sensitive and even be quite an ethical person on a day-to-day level, and yet still not have that sense of living in an animate universe, which is what we're talking about?
Yes, in a way.
What we're coming to is the sense of mystery about the world.
That's what I call the first order of ethics. You may have a little bit of the second order of ethics, but it doesn't go very far or very deep. And I suspect that today, for it to go further and deeper, there needs to be a supporting vision, if you see what I mean. I don't think it will just happen of its own accord. There's too much against it. So I think that's why environmentalism is not enough. There needs to be
a vision of what life is and what it's for, as it were, and of where it goes and what its supreme values are, which I think can then lead people to make the struggle, and it is a struggle, to go deeper in that sensitivity. I think whilst I want to emphasise the natural character of the sensitivity, I don't want you to understand that to mean that it's just going to happen. That natural sensitivity requires a great deal of conscious effort. It's a bit like having the natural capacity to run very fast, but you've got to train in order to do it, if you see what I mean. You've got the limbs, you've got the I don't know, whatever it is you've got, the genetic qualities. Well, yeah, I think you're left with this sort of sentimentalism that says that all humanity is good and all we need to do is remove the barriers to it. It's just not true. There needs to be a great deal of work. So I think that, yes, I've stressed the natural character of it, but I hope that I haven't misled you into thinking that that natural character naturally unfolds. It will unfold, naturally, if you give the right circumstances for it and have a conscious recognition of it and a desire for it to unfold. Ethics, that's what we do in Buddhism, isn't it? We recognise that ethics is, in a certain sense, natural and spontaneous, but we know that it requires a great deal of investigation, of self-inquiry, of learning to understand self better. Yes, so I think it's one of the interesting things about this the angle of approach that I'm taking based on Bante, that it brings into dialogue the as it were natural with the consciously undertaken.
So a question about the process of Vipassana, if you like. So my understanding is that if we're to examine our experience in terms of our right view, in terms of three actions, there's a sort of deconstruction of the of proliferation we've bundled on top of that. And I'm trying to, well, again, there seems like there's a couple of forces that we talked about before. It feels that the imaginal faculty is, if you like, bringing another sort of construction to our experience. I can't quite square those two things. The stripping down of experience.
Well,
from our projections.
Yes, in a certain sense, I can see what you mean. But what it amounts to is that it is a construction of experience that is far closer to the way things are. Do you see what I mean? I remember Bante talking about this in respect to deconstructing the ego. He said, you can't simply deconstruct the ego. And I think this is a problem with a lot of Vipassana discourse, not with the real practice. That it seems as if you can just deconstruct it and that's that. What actually happens is that you could deconstruct at a certain level, functionally speaking, and something new does emerge, which is still a construction, but it's a more adequate one that better is more in conformity with the way things are. So Bante gave the example of ordination. You know, you take on an identity as a Dhammachari or Dhammacharini, and it is in a certain sense an identity. But it's an identity that's more closely connected with the way things really are, and that then provides the basis for a further process of, if you like, deconstruction, or you could say reconstruction in the sense of rebirth. Now, Bante, I remember in the Tibetan Book of the Dead seminar, suggested that we should all have a new name every day. So that you're sort of constantly reconstructing your identity on a better and better basis. So taking the terms of your question, which I'm not completely comfortable with, but taking the terms of your question, I'd say that, yes, in that sense, the imagination could be considered to be still a construction of reality, but it's a construction of reality that's closer to reality, closer to the way things really are. Not merely in the descriptive sense, in the philosophical sense,
anyway, it's not at all in the philosophical sense, but in the I could only say imaginative sense, in the sense that you are connected with the way things really are. And this particularly applies to the imagination of the Buddha. Does that get anywhere near the spot for you?
I'm just wondering if there's any little bit of flesh you can put on those particular bones. It's I mean, you mentioned the imagination of the Buddha.
Hmm.
I'm just trying to imagine what.
Well, yes, I suppose that a wrong view is a construction of our experience that is contrary to the way things really are. A right view is a construction of our experience that is in conformity with the way things are. An imaginative experience, a symbolic imaginative experience, is close to at least an aspect of the way things really are via image and everything that goes with that, emotion and understanding. What Bhante calls illumined imagination, I haven't mentioned this term yet, illumined imagination is the image illumined by reality. So that the image carries the way things are, if you see what I mean. It's not merely an intermediary between the way things are and how they are. It is an intermediary between the way things are and ourselves. But it's not merely I'm having to think on my feet. An intermediary to a higher level of experience. It's an intermediary to reality itself.
The
jnana sattva, that's precisely the relationship. The samaya sattva is the karmically constructed image that is, to the extent that we're really able to invest it with emotional and psychic power, is extremely compelling. But when it becomes illumined, it's the container of the way things really are, to use a metaphor. So the image which is not illumined takes us closer to reality in the sense that it lessens the tension between subject and object, huh? So that in a classic meditation model in dhyana, you experience a lessening of the tension between subject and object. There is still subject and object, but they're very much closer. They're very much more in dialogue, in empathic connection. And it may become so great, and this is what clearly is meant by the Arupa Dhyanas, that it's really difficult to describe what the difference is. I sometimes draw in explaining this an asymptotic curve, two asymptotic curves, you know, graphs that get closer and closer to the vertical without ever touching it. So that indefinite prolongation gets them closer and closer, but they never meet. So that the karmic dimension of imaginative experience is of that kind. When it becomes illumined, there's a complete transcendence of that distinction as ultimately real, as containing any reality. So the unillumined image, which seems to belittle it, but the ordinary image, no, that even seems to belittle it, the image carries you into an experience of greater harmony of subject and object, we could put it that way, but not a transcendence of them. It's not spiritual, in your terms. It's not transcendental. So the illumined object is an object which is the conveyor for you of the way things really are, free, devoid of, beyond any real, substantial difference between subject and object. Does that get somewhere there? So for Bhante, the issue is that a lot of our discourse, and you see this a lot in modern expositors of Vipassana, it's sort of a technical
exposition, which seems to suggest that you just need to see. And because it's expressed in conceptual language, it seems as if it's a conceptual insight. I know this is not what the best people mean and real practitioners mean. But a lot of the language used by the amateurs of the art suggests this. So Bante thinks it's that there's a whole dimension of cultural and personal experience, psychological experience, which needs to be expressed, which is expressed principally in terms of imagination. So that, for instance, you come into a much more vivid interaction with the Buddha imaginatively than you do merely conceptually.
I suppose my sort of experience of the custom practice is that moving from there into an imaginative engagement with Yidam or whatever.
Yes.
It's a bit clunky to me.
Oh.
But there's.
Well, in a way, I agree with you, because I think that we've inherited a model of practice that is difficult for us, and is part of my whole enterprise, that I think we need to come at that whole area again. If you see what I mean. Well, not exactly again, but to yeah, no, again.
Okay, so a practice that focuses on deconstruction. In my experience, what that often leads to is what you've been describing, something closer to reality.
Yes, indeed.
And it's not constructive, it's maybe still a construction, but it's poetic.
Yes.
It's the kinesthetic sense that Satchin talked about this morning. So in a sense, it's a different way than I usually think about imagination as creating something.
I suppose, I was a bit impaled on the terms of his discussion. But yes, I wouldn't disagree with you.
Would you let her go at the mobile phone? Symptomatic of possibly a suggestion that we renounce a lot of new technology.
Well, I personally took a vow of technological brahmacharya, relative brahmacharya, which is much more difficult than the other kind. I've got the sort of mind that I could got fascinated by it. I could spend hours fiddling around with it, and I just thought, no, we don't. We don't all. We don't. But I think we need to examine what it does to us. And you may be all right. It may be fine for you. But we need to examine what it does to us. Everything you do has an effect on your mind. It's a karma. So I think that we, all of us, need to examine the effect that the technology we use has on our consciousness. Maybe a good one. I'm not wanting to prejudge. But... have a look. It's not a question of doctrine, it's a question of experience. My own conclusion for myself was that it was far more unhelpful than helpful. You know, I use a computer for writing, but beyond that, I've just decided not to go there. With some reluctance, although I'm quite glad not to now. But I certainly know people for whom it's not a natural attraction at all. Did I complete that for you? I think there is an issue.
I think if you reflect around the nature of your presentation of emphasising aesthetics in nature and animism, actually most of me is thinking, should I really be spending that amount of time on the internet and the iPod and the mobile phone?
I'd suggest don't. The question is worth asking, but the evidence is in your consciousness, is in your experience. Examine your experience. Have a week off. See what it does to you. and so forth. So you may be fine. I really don't want to say what it would be like for others, although I have my suspicions. Have a look and see. Sorry.
Unfortunately, I don't know very much about Thich Nhat Hanh's response, but sort of a way of going about things. But I was wondering about, you know, like some of his reflections are about sort of moving out to connect up with the conditions that have brought something about, which is not really a way of sort of reflecting that we've done very much in our movement. I wonder if that would be a way of. For instance, you've got food, and you sort of maybe reflect on that has brought that about. So in that way, you're boring and connected.
Well, I would hope that people did do that. I certainly do myself. Yeah.
Particularly emphasized.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. No, I think that was certainly to be encouraged. Even at the as it were, karmic level, to recognise your karmic debt in that sense. And I've always been so struck by that, the legend of the Buddha. Immediately after his enlightenment, he went and sat for 1 week and gazed at the Mahabodhi tree. And clearly what he was doing was expressing his gratitude. It's even put in that way. And he thanks the tree. So I think that we should take the Buddha's teaching very seriously and look at the factors that have benefited us. And especially, of course, Bhante's always encouraged this in terms of our parents.
Well, I think gratitude, I was sort of thinking of this as you were talking, I think gratitude has been highlighted more in our movement over the last few years, but a bit similar to Sujeeva's question. I was thinking, you know, I can feel gratitude, but does it really mean I've got this animating view of the world, really? Or do you see what I mean? I mean, maybe there is a connection, one would flow into another,
I think certainly that would be true, that if you did make some conscious effort to develop gratitude and you really felt it, it must mean that you feel there's something to be grateful to, if you see what I mean. If you think that a loaf of bread is just a bundle of atoms, it's hard to really feel grateful to it.
In the paper that you produced, where you said that we live in an ethical universe, because that was something that caused a lot of problems.
Yeah. I'm afraid it was a rather provocative comment, which it can be easily understood or misunderstood. But of course, the universe is not ethical in the sense that either it has a conscious intention. Or that everything's good. But what I meant was that ethics is built in the sense that karma is built in. That's all I meant.
Dimensions.
Sorry?
Surely I mean to the human dimensions.
Yes. But or any conscious entity that develops agency. And it's built in, you could say, in the Dharma Niyama too. So somebody did advise me not to put that in, and I foolishly disagreed. Actually, I'm more concerned about it from the Indian point of view, because it sounds like Neo-Vedanta. So I might modify that in another version. It was meant to be a little provocative, but that's got me into more trouble than anything else.